Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, episode 127, The Currency Act. Firstly, I'd like to begin with a production note. As I'm sure you're all aware, the past month has been highly disruptive for just about every single person on the earth, thanks to the COVID-19 virus. This has meant some certain changes in most of our lives. I'm extremely lucky in the fact that my job allows me to work from home, but it has meant that I've had to reorganise my flat into a home office of sorts, which has meant that my studio, as it existed, well, no longer exists. So part of what I've been doing over the past few weeks is resetting up everything. So this is my first ever recording using an Apple, my first ever using GarageBand, so it's a bit of a new setup, and it may take a little bit of time for me to A, know what I'm doing, and the sound might be a little bit different from what you're used to. But hopefully, it should still be as tolerable as my voice normally is. Well, anyway, let's just get on with it. So this is episode 127, The Currency Act. In our last episode, we began to look at the financial problems that were affecting the British in the years after the Seven Years' War. While the Grenville Ministry made efforts at raising revenue on the British side, the side attacks being a particularly fierce battle, they started to look at the Americas. It was decided that the American military would be expanded, which would allow for the large officer class to be retained. The first measure was the American Duties Act, more commonly known as the Sugar Act, an exercise in mercantilism that was bound to meet with colonial resistance. Almost simultaneously, in 1764, the Currency Act was passed. The Currency Act was a reaction to financial practices that had occurred in the colonies over the course of the war. In order to finance the conflict, colonies had produced large amounts of paper money. In the North, these currencies were backed by gold and silver, but in Virginia, they were backed by nothing. The idea being that future taxes could remove the notes from active circulation. The exchange rate between Virginia's currency and British pound sterling gradually increased and distanced itself from the official exchange rate. When a Dutch banking house collapsed in 1763, it sparked an international financial crisis. This spread from London and from there to the colonies. London bankers worried about payment being made in Virginia's currency. The Currency Act, which was proposed by a backbencher in the interests of the London merchants, made it illegal for private debts to be settled in currency minted in the colonies south of New England, New England being different because it was backed by hard currency. As this paper money was often the only medium of exchange in the Americas, this threw the colonies' economies into turmoil. Much like the American Duties Act, the American Currencies Act passed without debate and without opposition. Westminster and Whitehall believed that Americans could not be trusted, and they must be forced into supporting the empire. They remembered the hard, early years of the war, when Loudon struggled, not the successes of Pitt's partnership. It must be remembered that the American economy was not in the best of shapes anyway. Money had poured into the Americas during the war, but after the conquest of Canada, attention shifted away from the mainland. Soldiers were no longer spending money as they were no longer there. Workers were no longer required to build forts and roads. There was a series of bad harvests. Most Americans had less disposable income. When combined with bad exchange rates, this hurt the merchants and artisans. However, the atmosphere was still positive. People believed that things would recover when the war ended, and there was a surge of optimism in 1763, but this came grinding to a halt when the financial crisis sparked by the collapse of the Dutch Bank hit. Bankruptcies started spreading throughout the colonies. Life was particularly tough in the ports of the North, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. Life was easier in the rural hinterland, where farmers had the option of subsistence agriculture, but this wasn't an option further south amongst the tobacco plantations of the Chesapeake. One notable example of a struggling tobacco planter was Colonel George Washington. He maintained the lifestyle of a grandee, while his tobacco had a middling reputation and he failed to make profits. The only thing that saved him was an attempt to at least somewhat economise his household. He looked for other crops to grow, eventually shifting entirely into wheat from tobacco. He started producing brandy and he engaged in land speculation. He joined in the creation of a new company, the Mississippi Company, which was designed for each member to claim 2.5 million acres. This was in comparison to the 200,000 acres for each claim in the Ohio Company. This was in addition to the Great Dismal Swamp venture, where Washington looked at draining a swamp near the coast on the border between Virginia and North Carolina. Further south, the Carolinas were slipping into disorder. North Carolina was impoverished, while the South was thriving due to a demand for rice in southern Europe and British demands for indigo. This led to attempts by the planters to mineralise the political influence of the backcountry, which became a land of military deserters, escaped convicts, and fleeing debtors. As the rule of law had not yet spread to the backcountry, kangaroo courts and vigilante justice prevailed. The divisions now emerging for the first time in the Carolinas, the divide between the wealthy and the rest, could be seen throughout all of North America. There was the divide between the planters of the Carolina coast and the bandits of the backcountry. In Connecticut, there was the wealthy Anglican West and the poor Evangelical East. In Rhode Island, Newport battled with Providence. In New York, farmers and merchants in Albany and Long Island opposed the Anglican merchants of New York City. New Jersey was less divided than before the war, but East and West were still opposed to each other. Maryland and Pennsylvania, two proprietary colonies, were caught in gridlock in a polarised political system between the proprietors and anti-proprietary delegates in assemblies. As I've mentioned a couple of times now, Maryland was in such a bad way that its governor could form no consensus with the lower house of the assembly that the colony had no involvement in the Seven Years' War. The Quaker faction had withdrawn from politics in Pennsylvania, and a new faction around Benjamin Franklin and the Philadelphia elite had emerged. But after the war, the Penns attempted to reimpose themselves by forming an alliance with the Westerners and the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. In Georgia, a young and weak colony, the governor was able to rule without opposition, while Governor Wentworth dominated New Hampshire. Strong governors existed elsewhere, but in Virginia and Massachusetts, oppositions were able to emerge. The Virginian gentry was of one mind, and the House of Burgesses could form a united front against the governor if they chose. In Massachusetts, the general court was more factionalised, and Governor Barnard and Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson were able to maintain a majority, although there were signs of cracks by early 1764. All this gives a sense of the colonies being in flux, and that the sense of political unity achieved by the governors throughout the war, with the exceptions of New Hampshire and Georgia, was dissolving. And we can safely say, none of this was understood by Grenville and the British elites in London. When the early reforms started to arrive, such as the Currency Act and the American Duties Act, the reaction was one of unease. The Boston Merchant Society for Encouraging Trade and Commerce instructed the Boston General Court on May 24, 1764, quote, "As you represent a town which lives its trade, we expect in a very particular manner that you make it the object of your attention to support our commerce in all its just rights, to vindicate it from all unreasonable impositions and promote its prosperity. Our trade has for a long time laboured under great discouragements, and it is with the deepest concern that we see such further difficulties coming upon it as will reduce it to the lowest ebb, if not totally obstruct and ruin it. What still heightens our apprehensions is those unexpected proceedings may be preparatory to new taxes upon us, for if our trade may be taxed, why not our lands? Why not the produce of our lands and everything we possess or make use of? This, we apprehend, annihilates our charter right to govern and tax ourselves. It strikes at our British privileges, which, as we have never forfeited them, we hold in common with our fellow subjects who are natives of Britain. If taxes are laid upon us in any shape, without ever having a legal representation where they are laid, we are not reduced from the character of free subjects to the miserable state of tributary slavery." End quote. This was the voice of Samuel Adams. Born in 1722 to a merchant and a deacon, Sam Adams studied at Harvard College. His parents intended for him to follow in his father's footsteps and to join the church, but he developed an interest in politics. After displaying his terrible business acumen involving a failed malt house, he took up a position as a clerk in 1747 before becoming a tax collector in 1756. He then became one of the principal voices opposing British interference in the colonies and promoting virtuous politics, which placed him in opposition with Thomas Hutchinson, the Lieutenant Governor and ultimate political insider of Massachusetts. James Otis, who we've briefly dealt with before, continued his vocal opposition, notably with his pamphlet, The Right of the British Colonies Asserted and Proved. Like with Adams in the speech we've just looked at, Otis too centred his arguments on the colonists' right as British citizens. As I've been talking about for some time now in this series, one of the fundamental causes of the American Revolution was the different interpretations of the Glorious Revolution, with the British focusing on parliamentary sovereignty and the Americans on the right of no taxation without representation. Privately, Hutchinson agreed with Adams and Otis, though he focused outwardly on the effects of trade rather than a rights issue as to not offend Parliament. This broke down the objections into regular business for provincial politics. The process repeated itself in New York, but elsewhere the reaction was milder. The American Duties Act was quietly accepted, while Rhode Island, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and Virginia all sent delegations to London to oppose the introduction of a Stamp Act. All these efforts had the notable feature of being completely uncoordinated. With no foreign threat to unify them and no commander-in-chief to direct them, the colonies had rapidly descended back into infighting that rendered cooperation impossible. In Massachusetts and Rhode Island, a small number of correspondence committees started to emerge, signalling that the frustration the Americans felt was shared. But this was not enough to stop Whitehall pressing ahead with the Stamp Act, which will be the focus of our next episode. Thanks for listening. I'll see you then.